Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday the 13th. Some may see it as a bit of bad luck that northern Wisconsin is dealing with flood damage for the second time in 2 years. In this hour, we're going to hear from the mayors of Ashland and Superior about efforts to control runoff from these storms. But first, the Superior City Council has a stacked agenda for next Tuesday's meeting, and on the list of items to be addressed is a resolution to provide around $1.4 million in bonds for an 86-unit apartment complex in Superior. The city's mayor, Jim Payne, sat down with me this week to talk about the housing project and efforts to address stormwater issues in the city. Tell me a little bit about this project and what it would do and why bonding would be used for that.
Okay, so from PNR's perspective, this would be project number 3 in Superior. The counting is a little funny because the first one was in the village of Superior, the village apartments, not the city. The second one is the Onyx building, which just fully formally opened and had everybody move in. That's full. That's kind of right behind Cathedral Church where Central High School used to be. So they are building a third and the largest building yet, which we are tentatively calling the F Street Project right now because that's the name of the street that runs right next to it. I'm sure they'll get a really nice name eventually, too. That's developed in a TIF district that was previously used for commercial projects, namely hotels. That's where the Hampton is. It's going to be right behind the Hampton and the Holiday Inn Express off of Highway 2. It's on an undeveloped space of basically industrial wetland. It's an industrial area. Next to a small little neighborhood, but it's undeveloped space. And so it's going to be their biggest project yet. But these guys who've done some fantastic projects in the city already, their capital was a little bit maxed out and they weren't able to get full financing to kick this project off. So what we did is we used tax increment financing, which is to use that in a mixed use residential district. That's a new tool we have from the state. And what we're basically allowing them to do is we're paying for their incentive from their future tax payments. So there are no taxes paid on that property right now because it's undeveloped. It's obviously going to be worth a whole lot once you put a massive valuable apartment complex on it. And so we're going to use that increment, the difference between zero and what they're going to pay every year, to pay down a loan that gets this project going.
You said that you're going to be using a new tool from the state. What's new about it or can you explain that?
Yeah, it's mixed use district TIF increment financing. Previously, you could really only use tax increment financing TIF for commercial and industrial projects. And there's a whole bunch of rules on that already. But recently, the legislature opened it up to some residential in what's called mixed use districts. So residential can only take up a certain percentage of the TIF. It's still got to have a commercial or industrial component to it. In this case, it's a commercial component, that being the hotels. So to me, it's still fairly residential. It's just a matter of how long people are staying. Some folks live in that neighborhood, or own houses in that neighborhood. Some folks will rent their homes in the apartment building. Some folks are there for a night or two at the hotel.
Well, as you mentioned, it's the third project by PNR Properties. So, I mean, we all know about the housing need in the city, but what's made the difference in recent years where we've seen these developments pop up?
Just these guys, mostly. But there's also been a changing attitude in how we look at housing. So for years, we always looked at the importance of single-family housing, and that is important when we look at the ratio of single-family housing to rentals in Superior. There's a pretty high rental threshold, but that's not the full story. One of the problems in Superior is we have single-family structures, you know, houses that are acting as rentals. They're being rented out. What we want is for folks that are renting, that want to live the lifestyle of a rental for financial or personal or quality of life reasons, to live in apartments, you know, to increase density, and single-family houses to go to single families, to homeowners. So by increasing density, increasing the availability of affordable, high-quality market rate rentals, and again, I say affordable, not subsidized, because it fits well within the market, we decrease a little bit of the pressure on that rental market and create opportunities for people to locate in Superior that otherwise might not have, namely folks living in Duluth.
So what kind of success are you seeing with people living in single family homes moving into these newer apartments? I mean, they are market rate, and so it's a little bit higher up there for mm-hmm. some people.
Still a little too early to say. Chances are folks moving into these apartment buildings were renting before. That's pretty fair to say, but a lot of them may have been living in rental houses. what we can say is they are successful. You know, we won't be able to look at all these true statistics for another year or two when we redo a housing study. But for right now, I mean, Onyx has only been open a couple of weeks now. But we know what that looks like. We know that folks are moving from Duluth or Minnesota in general. And we know that folks are moving from other parts of the city to live in this space.
Well, what else is happening with that project, the apartment complex? You are going to be passing a resolution related to that?
Yeah, we have a little bit of work left to do there. The agreement is finalized. They have closed on their financing. That's news as of today. So they are ready for the bonding, which council has to approve actually borrowing the money to pay this incentive. Now, council's made a deal with PNR Properties to do the project. So we have to do the project at this point. But how we fund it is up to the council. And so we are proposing bonding it. That's generally been how this project's been explained since the beginning. This is not controversial. I think this is going to easily pass the council, but that's the final stage in getting this project done.
Well, has anyone said or raised questions about bonding? Because, I mean, essentially down the line, it amounts to a property tax increase for residents in the city, right?
Yeah, and in the long term, they get it right back because this project was generating, or this space was generating no revenue at all. Now it will generate revenue that will pay this debt service back and pay back this bond. That's how we're paying for that. So we can increase the levy to cover that bond, but in this case, we really don't need to do that. We're borrowing against the TIF. So the building itself pays its debt payments. So as soon as they make that first property tax payment next year on their brand new building, we use that money to pay down this debt. So this is not like a regular levy increase. Now, it does go with all other debt service. This is a little bit in the financial weeds here. So, and we can raise the levy to cover that debt service and put the PNR money right back in the TIF. But ultimately, what we're doing here is generating new revenue for the city. Now, if we don't want to increase the levy, that becomes a budget question. That's a policy priority in the general fund budget that we're building right now.
Well, you're also proposing to issue bonds for sewer improvements or improvements to the city sewer system. Can you talk about what's going on there and what you're looking at doing?
Yeah, so that's it's fairly simple, but really important. It is worth noting that this is a wetland that we're building on. It's a low quality wetland. It's not the kind of high quality wetland that generates an ecosystem that is really mitigating a lot of water in the city. It's pretty industrial. It's a grass field. It's a wet grass field is what it is. But because it's a grass field, it's so holding and soaking up some water. Not only does that water have to go somewhere in the future, but it's going to generate all new water. It won't sit on a building in a parking lot. It's going to run off. And so it's got we need to make some improvements to handle that new water that previously would have been used by vegetation or sat on this wet ground. And that's going to require some infrastructure improvements right there.
How are you planning, I guess, to divert that water or retain it so that you're not seeing increased runoff in the city?
Oh, there will be increased runoff. It's just a matter of we are adding it to our stormwater system. So we improve the infrastructure that can take the water and move it in a safe and clean way back out to Lake Superior, like any other development project in Superior. However, I mean, if I could transition now, we have a lot of work going on in the city's period, including on Tuesday, about how we manage stormwater runoff in general. A position we should start from is any runoff is bad runoff. Well, any human-created runoff is bad runoff. So water is supposed to move through the city's period. It's a really, really wet place. And so when we develop the city, it moves that water faster and it makes it dirtier. It's going over concrete, it's going over human created spaces, and it's carrying pollutants, contaminants at a very rapid rate to Lake Superior. So the speed of the water does damage and the stuff that it picks up along the way does damage. So we are engaged in a number of efforts to mitigate that, to stop it from getting to Lake Superior altogether, to use the water to clean it up before we ever have to touch it. And the only way to really do that is with green infrastructure. And we have a number of projects moving forward to increase the green infrastructure we have in the city.
And you are looking at a green infrastructure audit at the council meeting on Tuesday night, right?
Right, right.
So tell me about the audit and your plans for green infrastructure in the city or what's being proposed.
So it's a couple of things. The audit is it's not the start, but it's a really great step forward for the city to look and see what have we been doing kind of backwards. It's first, it recognizes that nobody mitigates stormwater better than Mother Nature. Trees drink water. Plants drink water. Anything that's green slows it down or outright holds it. So anything that's green at all, anything that grows, is good for our stormwater system. So when it rains and the water rolls off your roof onto a sidewalk, out to a street, into a storm drain, through a concrete pipe, out to Lake Superior, that's not good for our city. It's not good for our lake. If it hits your roof and it rolls into your garden, or it rolls into bushes, or even some overgrown, what people might think of as weeds, or a ditch with vegetation, it may not get any further than that. If we get even more dramatic and it doesn't even roll off the roof because the entire roof has stuff growing on it, like the Yellow Jacket Union on this campus, then it's even better. We can have a system where a lot of stormwater doesn't even touch the ground. So what we're doing is we're looking at our code of ordinances to see, of all the rules we've put on homeowners and businesses, what is getting in the way of them just doing the right thing for our stormwater system? What can we do to not even incentivize so much as just allow people to do new and innovative things? Now, we do that at the City of Superior. We have a number of rain gardens and major projects that we're doing, but we want to get everybody on board with this as well.
So is this something new that you are doing, or is something you've been working on for a long time? I'm just thinking about, you know, the recent events, the flooding that we've seen. You know, does it feel more urgent now to be doing something like this?
Oh, I would love nothing more than to take full credit for this because it's just that cool. But it was something that a number of the scientists and ecologists and staff at the Environmental Services Division brought to me right after the election, that they would like to pursue a grant with city support to undertake this audit. And so I did support that immediately from after taking office, and they got to work on it pretty quick. We won the grant, and there will be some significant contribution from the city to both review and then ultimately implement the recommendations of the audit. The audit has just started. The council is going to learn a little bit more about it and finally approve the process here, but it's going to take some time for them to come up with some clear recommendations, but it'll include some outright ordinance changes within the city.
Okay, so it just started, and how long will it go on?
I think 6 months to a year will be the audit stage, and then it will likely generate a comprehensive plan or generate recommendations for some comprehensive planning that we have underway already. It will put recommendations into those plans, and it will make direct recommendations for immediate policy changes. So we'll be changing some ordinances right away based on those recommendations. And then ongoing, we will have long-term planning that seeks to make the entire city more green.
It will cover homeowners and businesses.
Yep. And to a large extent, the city. You know, we want to get rid of rules that prevent people from developing green infrastructure. A great example, if you walk through the neighborhoods of the city of Minneapolis, you're going to find a lot of homeowners that don't have lawns anymore, that have gigantic gardens, really, but they're not vegetable or flower gardens like you might see here. Their just entire yard is overgrown with vegetation. Overgrown is a bad word because in a lot of cases, it looks stunningly beautiful. A lot of wild plant life that is indigenous to the area is growing in their front yards. And what that does is it means that very little water is escaping their property. They are using the water that lands on their property. They're becoming responsible homeowners. You wouldn't be able to do that in the city of Superior. It's against the law.
Because we have ordinances against blight, or?
Yep, that's why they were designed. So the reason those ordinances were designed was so that you can't just not mow your lawn and let the whole thing get overgrown. But there's a difference between somebody who just neglects their property and lets it get overgrown and somebody that makes a concerted effort to help the environment. Aesthetics will still matter. Neighborhood integrity still matters. And so that's what makes this so challenging. It's why we don't just get rid of those rules. We have to replace them with something that still protects the other people in the neighborhood. But it's worth noting what we're doing right now is bad for the environment. We're requiring people to create more stormwater.
Well, anything that you wanted to add about the green infrastructure audit and proposals related to that?
Well, not the audit necessarily, but again, it's part of a wider vision to make the city more green and friendlier to our surrounding environment. So we have a couple of other projects moving forward. The Wisconsin Point Dune Restoration Project, to a small extent, but especially the Barker's Island Beach Improvement Project and an upcoming project on the parking lots in the southern part of Barker's Island that will dramatically improve the way that we treat Lake Superior.
How will it do that?
A lot of the things I just explained. So it'll a lot of pervious pavers as opposed to impervious pavers. Impervious pavers mean the water can't get through it at all. Concrete, blacktop are impervious surfaces. Pervious surfaces are strong surfaces that you can still drive on, you can still walk on, park your car there, but it lets the water through and into the ground and therefore doesn't run it straight off into the lake. Other rain gardens, green space within parking lots. So instead of an open sea of asphalt, you have it broken up with a lot of green. So instead of the water running off and into our stormwater system, it runs into green collection points filled with plants and flowers. Great way to see an example of this. Barker's Island has green infrastructure parking lot right now on the northern side where you park for the festival. Has just right in the middle of it, you go right around a lot of vegetation that is planted there specifically to catch the water. So water doesn't leave that parking lot. It's used by the plants that are in that parking lot. We're going to do that to some of the other spaces too.
Okay. Well, anything else I'm missing, Mayor, that you want to add about next Tuesday night's council meeting?
Oh, there's probably plenty of fun stuff going on next Tuesday's council meeting. We had a week off by the 4th of July, so we're gonna clean up a lot of business. But that's the stuff I'm most excited about.
Okay. And then 6:30 in the city council chambers?
That's right. That's right. Everybody's invited.
Okay. Thanks, Mayor.
Of course.
Again, you were just listening to Superior Mayor Jim Payne. Up next, we turn to Ashland, where June flooding caused around 15 million gallons of untreated water and sewage to overflow from the city's wastewater treatment plant. Ashland Mayor Deb Lewis says stormwater runoff is a growing concern that the city hopes to do more to address.
What's on a lot of people's minds in our community is the continued sediment in the bay. Following the storm on Father's Day that we had, where all of the clay runoff happened. And the other factor is the condition of our beaches and, you know, the inability to use them due to high bacteria levels. So that's a serious problem that we're facing. And, you know, I kind of want to shine a spotlight on that issue. It's one that's going to require a lot of will and long-term planning and lots of money to fix. There are some things being done. The Burke Center, the Water Center through Northland College, is working on a pilot program for some of the land adjacent to the waterways that lead into the bay to work on controlling erosion, and we're going to need to really ramp it up as we see a continuation of the more frequent storms that used to be really rare are becoming more frequent, and the consequences of that are becoming very visible to all of us. And that's going to mean improving our infrastructure in the water containment system. It's going to involve, I think it's going to involve a lot of people. And, you know, it's going to, you know, we're going to be pushing for some real simple things like more rain gardens in the community. Every little bit that we can do to just control that runoff.
Do you feel like there's a lot that you can do to help with that, or because I'm just thinking
about? I do. I do feel like, you know, it can seem really overwhelming and hopeless, but we have to start somewhere. You know, we're looking at erosion control, and obviously we need to expand the capacity of our sewer system our wastewater management system. We're doing that on an ongoing basis as we replace underground infrastructure. You know, we're increasing the size of our stormwater systems, but it's going to take a long time. So that's of concern.
So is there anything that's going to be happening in the near future that you're proposing for residents to... as far as efforts to address that issue?
I think as a council, we're going to be looking at a strategic plan to comprehensively address that issue. We've started some of that with our water source protection plan that we've been working on. That's been ongoing. That looks at, threats to the water you know, from outside sources, including agricultural runoff, which is a lot of what we're seeing right now. So it's, you know, it's not any one thing. It's going to take a real concerted effort to do this, and we've got to get going on it.
So what's the next step then? You're bringing something up at the council meeting, or?
Yes, we will be talking about that in the very near future.
Okay.
Gathering, you know, kind of doing a survey of what's being done now, and really identifying what the city's role is. What can we realistically do? How can we help promote efforts that are being done, like the efforts of the Burke Center? How can we help, you know, empower the citizens to do their part? And I don't even know all the things that can be done. I do know rain gardens are helpful, but just really start promoting those things that we know can be helpful.
Okay.
So, city council meeting went very well last night. We're changing the time of our start time for our meetings from 6:15 to 5:30 to help enable people who maybe want to stop into the meeting on their way home from work rather than having to come in afterwards. So that was a change that was made. We also accepted a grant from the AARP Community Challenges Grant Program to install 5 bike repair stations along our lake trail and our corridor. We have about 20 miles of trail within the city limits, and we're going to be putting bike repair stations for bikers. We're trying to become a more bike-friendly community. We have approved a bike plan in the last 6 months, and we're going to be starting to implement by marking some streets that are bike paths and just trying to encourage a more bike-friendly community. We have installed numerous bike racks downtown that were created and designed by WITC welding class students. So this is another step towards that, and that was a really happy thing we did.
Why is also that important for the city to be becoming more bike friendly?
We have a number of people that are attracted to this area because of our amenities such as biking. These are younger people who are very active and enjoy the recreational aspects of our lifestyle, and those are the kind of people we need to attract. You know, in order to have a sustainable future, we need more young people who are active and want to be here, enjoy that kind of thing. So it's a very positive thing. We know that the generation of workers that we have now is less likely to move to somewhere because of a job, but rather because of recreational opportunities and amenities that are available. And we know this is one, we hear from many of them that this is what they want.
Okay.
Including the ones that are already here. Then the biggest things we did, number one, we approved a contract for the new city administrator. I'm happy to say we will be having a new administrator join us. He will be starting with the city August 27th. And his name is Brant Kuchera. He was chosen out of a little over 20 applicants from all over the place. We had a committee who narrowed the field down, and then we did interviews by phone, and then we did final interviews with the council and department heads, and he was chosen. He's coming to us right now from Oregon. He does have ties to the Midwest, including to the UP. He's an experienced administrator with an MBA. So we're really excited to have him. It's been a stretch of time where we have been without a city administrator, and so I'm particularly excited about that. The second thing we did that is significant was we approved a global agreement for the Ashland Highway 2 sewer litigation. And what that was an agreement among the defendants in the case. If you recall, the sewer litigation case started about 10 years ago and resulted from some road construction on Highway 2 that had erroneously installed the wrong size connectors in the sewer system, which had resulted in some backups to some of the homeowners and landowners along the highway. So that's been a very complicated, long involved process to get those things done, to get the repairs completed. But the global agreement was an agreement among the defendants to not have arbitration. The repairs have been, there were three defendants in the case, including the city of Ashland, and the agreement at the beginning was that we were going to get the repairs done. The three defendants were going to initially share the cost of the repairs equally, and then at the end we were supposed to go to arbitration. The parties have now agreed not to go to arbitration, but to leave things as they are. And so the result for the city is that our insurer has paid all along the city's share of those repairs and also the attorney fees in this case. So it's a very optimum solution for the city. And I will just note that there are a few property owners along the way. This is a very complicated thing. And the lawsuit, which was a class action lawsuit, was really about one issue, and that was the faulty couplings or the connectors. And so there's a few landowners who had other issues that were discovered as part of this remediation and were not happy that their problems were not fixed, but they were unrelated to this lawsuit. And so we have a couple of those out there, but hopefully those will be resolved in a different manner. But for the most part, I think there were 40 properties that were repaired, and it was a very complicated process, and I'm happy to say we're coming to the end.
Are there still repairs that are being made right now, or is that...
There are two remaining repairs. However, there's an agreement as to who's going to pay for them. We're tying up the loose ends and trying to have this all completed by the end of the month.
Anything else that the city is working through right now or has been a big project?
We are moving forward on plans to develop a new police facility. We had selected an architect about a year and a half ago, and we have done a site search and an analysis of different sites around the community and have settled on a location. So we have a site, and now we have a site plan and a approved conditional use permit. The location is on 11th Avenue West. It would be the east side of 11th Avenue West, between the 5th Street corridor and 6th Street. So it's on the site of the old Chicago Iron. So the council has approved that site, and we're working on interior final design. And the interesting thing about this facility is we want it to be a sustainable facility. We're hoping to have solar electricity and energy efficient windows and insulation and some kind of sustainable heating system. We want it to be a long-term solution for the issue of where the police department is housed. So we're doing a public meeting for that, a public information session next Thursday, the 19th, at 6:30 at City Hall.
Since you mentioned solar, I was also curious, you know, you've had this solar garden now in Ashland.
Yes.
How is that supposed to be benefiting the city as far as reducing costs?
We actually just formed a sustainability committee that's going to be working on some of these things. And we have not yet made a decision about buying shares into that. But the solar garden is basically a program where you subscribe to the garden. Basically, you buy shares in it, and you pay an amount up front, a lump sum up front. And then in return for that, you get a credit on your electrical bill. So there's no installation on your properties. There's no panels or anything anywhere. You're just paying for that. Ultimately, if it's expanded, it could have a big impact. We are hopeful that solar can be used more and more in this area, and it will eventually, in the long term, save for individual owners, property owners. Also, this summer at the same time, there's been a group buy in the Schwamigan Bay area. It's the largest group buy that's happened in the state of Wisconsin, where individual property owners can have solar panels installed on their house. And because it's a group buy, the price is much lower than it would if you did it individually. So we're seeing that happening too. So depending on the cost of materials, we're hopeful that we can keep the momentum going for that.
We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll shift from talking about efforts to control stormwater to a new study that examines water quality of private wells in northern Wisconsin. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we're talking about a new study that aims to get a better idea of what's in the drinking water of private well owners across northern Wisconsin. Kelsey Prihoda is a researcher with the Lake Superior Research Institute at UW-Superior. She received a roughly $56,000 grant from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources to test 700 water samples for fluoride. Prihoda sat down with me this week to talk about the study and what prompted it.
It actually started for personal reasons. I have a small child at home, and I had brought him to the dentist for the very first time, and I am on private well water, and the dentist had spoken with me about that and asked if we had ever gotten the fluoride level tested in our groundwater, and I said no. And he explained that we probably should, because there could be there are areas within northwestern Wisconsin, northeastern Minnesota that may have high naturally occurring fluoride levels, and areas that might have low naturally occurring fluoride levels. So there you may need to supplement or you may not. And I thought, holy cow, if I am not aware of this, then, and I feel like, you know, I'm pretty up on water quality issues. I've been working in as a toxicologist for about 10 years at this point, and I feel like, you know, probably not a lot of people are aware of this. And so I had since then this idea kind of just ruminating, until I found a funding source that was specific for groundwater quality monitoring and research, and that finally happened this past fall. And so the idea is twofold. Number one, education. So making sure that people within northwestern Wisconsin are aware that there should be some basic level of understanding of their water, groundwater quality, especially those that are using groundwater as their primary drinking source. So just kind of spreading the word, increasing awareness, empowering people to get the knowledge that they need to go out and get their well water tested. But then the second part of this research project is to gather data, essentially. And so we're pretty lucky in this area, because we have not a lot of human impact on our groundwater. We don't have a lot of really, really large scale industries. We don't have a lot of confined animal feeding operations or really large commercial scale agriculture. So as far as human contaminants go, we're pretty lucky. And the thing that we don't know is we don't have a lot of baseline data. Just what is our groundwater quality right now? But we do know that there are naturally occurring elements and minerals in rocks, and that those elements and minerals and ions can then leach into the groundwater. And in most cases, they would be present at a certain level that is important for us to understand and know, that baseline level, because there could be either aesthetic, so what it could affect the way that your water tastes or smells or looks, or there could in some cases be some health effects that people should realize and just be aware of. So that was sort of the basis for the project, and we applied for funding and were able to get funding from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And so the project actually just started July 1st.
What might be the concerns related to fluoride if that's leaching into private wells or groundwater?
So fluoride isn't so much of an acute health concern as some of the other things that we're studying in this project. So we're doing fluoride. So it started, the idea started with fluoride, and we're collecting, we're targeting about 700 fluoride samples, but we're also doing naturally occurring metals as well. So those include things like arsenic, iron, manganese, and aluminum. And so among those metals, arsenic would be the one that is the most of an acute health concern of everything that we're studying. The thing about fluoride is that there's a pretty narrow range of what we call therapeutic concentration. So if it's present in your drinking water anywhere between 0.7 and 1.5 milligrams per liter, that's the area that we want to see for really strong, healthy teeth and bone development. So that's what we, if you had that in your groundwater and that was your primary drinking source, you would be lucky, because you would be taking in just the right amount of fluoride that you need. If it's less than that, then it actually is conducive to having some sort of a dental cavity, tooth decay sort of thing. So we would want in that situation to supplement with some sort of a fluoride varnish or fluoride treatment. If it's above that, that's where you start to see some issues sort of on the other end of the spectrum, where there are some malformations in the enamel on teeth. And if it gets to be a very high level, say 10 milligrams per liter, can actually affect bone development. So because it has such a narrow range of therapeutic concentration, we feel like it's really important that we have a better understanding of just county to county within our 11 county study range, exactly what the naturally occurring concentrations are, so that people are a little bit more empowered to be able to say, I might need some supplementation here, because it seems that in my county the concentration of fluoride that is naturally occurring in groundwater is really low.
Why are you studying some of these other metals then, like aluminum and manganese and arsenic and iron?
Yeah, so the reason for that was because, again, we have just a general lack of data. And so if you look at this well water quality viewer, a lot of the metals that we are studying as part of this project are built into that well water quality viewer. So it's a very good way to look and see what the existing data set is. And for Douglas County, there's really nothing. There's no data. It's just kind of a big blank spot. And so originally, our original idea was to really collect all of the metals samples in Douglas County, just so that we can build up that data set a little bit. But then through the DNR's request, we actually ended up being able to expand throughout the 11 counties. And the reason that we're looking at those is because, number one, it's just a lack of data. We need more knowledge. With that knowledge, we can do some more research-driven, hypothesis-driven studies where we can pose a question based on this baseline level of data and try to answer it with a more targeted approach. Right now, we're just on a data gathering mission. And so some of these metals like arsenic can be toxic to humans in pretty low quantities. And so for that reason, and because it's naturally occurring, we feel like it's really important that people know, are aware that there might be areas within northwestern Wisconsin where that's something that you really need to get tested in your well water, just based on this data set that we're going to be collecting. There are other ones in our study that may not be so acutely toxic as arsenic, like iron. But they could have aesthetic effects on your water. So it's a kind of a quality of life issue. If your water is full of iron and it tastes in a way that you just, it tastes so bad that you can't drink it, that's a quality of life issue. And so we're just trying to, like I said, gather data so that hopefully we can down the road do more targeted research to learn more about the groundwater quality, so that if in the future there are big industries that come in or some sort of contaminant level occurrence to our, that would affect our groundwater, that we would be able to know what changes had occurred based on those impacts, like human impacts on groundwater. So we need to know where we're starting from so that we know, you know, in the future, if there are any environmental issues that occur, what changes actually occurred to our groundwater quality.
So do you have any sense why we don't have any baseline data right now, or how common that is across Wisconsin?
The thing is that we have in northwestern Wisconsin a really large proportion of people that are on well water. I think we're pretty unique in that way. And so private wells do not, there's no requirement that they be monitored, as opposed to a public well situation where, like a bar or a restaurant that might serve 25 or more people, those need to be monitored routinely, so annual monitoring. So we have, but even though in those cases the parameters that are monitored are limited to bacteria and nitrate, and so we focus on those two things because of the toxicity level. So just in general, the compounds that we're studying as part of this project are just not compounds that, even if people were to say sell their house and have to get their well water tested as part of the real estate transaction, it's not very common that you would have fluoride tested in your water. It's just not something that's done routinely. And that's why this project is focused so much on education as well, so that people know, number one, that they should test their well water, and number two, what compounds, you know, should you look at, because they could be different. If you have small children in your house, there are compounds that you might want to test, whereas other folks without children might you know, not need to test for all of the whole suite of things.
Does the 700 samples that you're doing for fluoride also include 700 samples for all these other metals as well? You want to get 700 of each of these?
Unfortunately, no, although it would be great. The focus of this project is really getting a really large data set for fluoride in groundwater from these 11 counties that are in our project. And so that's why we're targeting 700 samples for fluoride. But then for the metals that we're analyzing, there's going to be 111 of those samples. So we have 11 counties. We're hoping for 10 sample sets from each county for the metals. And then for the fluoride, again, we're just hoping to have a really good representation from all 11 counties so that we have a pretty good baseline data set. But, you know, we're kind of at the mercy of volunteers and where they're located, and we're not going out and collecting these samples ourselves. They're all going to be volunteer collected samples, so it is all sort of up to how it plays out in the end and where the volunteers are located themselves. And so we might have more volunteers from one county than another, but we're really going to try hard to get really good representation from all of them.
When are you hoping to have all of these samples collected by, and when do you hope to go through that and then present your findings?
Timeline of the project is, this project is an 18-month project, so not very long, and that's why we're really pushing hard to collect a lot of samples right up front. So the project just started July 1st, and we would like to get as many samples as we can collected by the end of December of this year. And hopefully we'll be able to achieve that. If not, hopefully by at the very latest, early spring 2019, and then we would have some public dissemination of the results closer to December 2019, which is when the project ends.
Is there anything that I'm missing that you want to add?
The only thing is some promotion on my part that right now we have a partnership with North Lakes Community Clinic, who has locations throughout the 11 county study area, and they are a great partnership for us. But we're also looking for additional project partners. So these are people who would disseminate, or essentially they would distribute the sampling kits that we are going to be providing to people, so that they can collect the water samples themselves from their own private wells. And so the sampling kits themselves would be free, the analysis is free, the people that participate in the study would get a report with the results, and so that's all paid for by grant funding. But we really are looking for partnerships like dental offices, like pediatricians, like anybody that deals with in the healthcare field. We are hoping that we would be able to get, you know, that they would be able to get in touch with us, and that we would be able to work with them to get these kits out to the folks that want to volunteer to participate in the study and get some data on their well water quality.
Again, you were just listening to Kelsey Prihoda, a researcher with the Lake Superior Research Institute at UW-Superior. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll shift from talking about what's in the water up north to what went into making the latest album from Northern Wisconsin musician Yasmin Bowers. Al Ross with Spectrum West at Wisconsin Public Radio in Eau Claire brings us that interview. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Northern Wisconsin is home to many talented musicians, and Yasmin Bowers grew up surrounded by them. Her mother is Hope McLeod, and her father is Bruce Bowers, a founding member of the Lake Superior Big Top Chautauqua Blue Canvas Orchestra. Yasmin has a pretty extensive music resume herself, and she recently spoke with Wisconsin Public Radio's Spectrum West host, Al Ross, about her latest album, Nautilus.
Well, how are you?
I am doing good. Yeah, we're on the road at the moment.
What do people call you for short? Do they call you Yaz?
Yeah, my friends call me Yaz.
Okay,
it's,
cool.
It's kind of a nickname.
All that Yaz. Have you had fun with your name with albums? And...
That's a good idea. Yes, I've had some ideas, but never followed through with any of them.
Yaz Mataz would be good too.
There you go. So.
Well, let's dive into talking about a few things. The new CD, that's exciting. It's called The Nautilus. The album, I learned, is about love. Six chapters, six phases, lessons you learned. So I have six questions.
Oh, lovely.
You ready?
I like it. Yes.
Okay, so why Nautilus? Why now? It's content... To me, after seeing your interviews and listening to music, is so deeply rooted in human existence that I wonder whether or not it's part of a process you're going through, or possibly maybe process is what all your music is about.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you definitely picked up on it. For me, music is always a process. It's always a way of transmitting what I am feeling and hopefully being able to connect with others through that. And yeah, this particular album came about because of a process that I've been going through. I think we all in life go through phases of times where there's like tremendous growth, and tremendous growth usually comes with tremendous pain. So there's that way of learning from it and growing to the next part of the Nautilus. And I guess that spiral just came to me as I was going through these things as a metaphor for how we grow outwards.
I'm trying not to think about the submarine, but hey, you know, I'm doing okay. I can imagine the shell, and it was easy because you had the shell with you on all those interviews and you set it down. All right, well, so we're talking about processes or processes, whichever is the plural. Let's talk about the writing process. I ask all musicians about that. I think it's about time I did an album, or Does one song or one life chapter spawn an album spark? Because albums, as you know, are a big undertaking and not to be taken lightly. They're how you're defined as a musician, ultimately. Time to do an album? Did you have everything you needed to put one together? Tell me that process.
Sure, yeah. Well, for me, it's more a matter, I'm always writing songs.
Okay.
I can't stop writing songs, and I probably have 10 times as many songs as I need for the next 5 albums. That's never a problem for me. However, the act of actually making it into an album is where I think it needs to come together in the right timing, the right collection of songs. And for me, it's been 7 years since my last release. Things have changed. I went to school. I did a lot of stuff. But it felt like it was time. Not only that, I kind of, in going through what I went through in the last couple of years, I was writing constantly. It was after the fact, after going through all that, I looked back and I realized, oh, I wrote an album.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Well, that makes
sense.
Because
they all made sense together, all the songs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Where do you store your songs? I mean, obviously, in today's technology, it's kind of easy.
Yeah, for me, it's my phone. I always sing it into a phone right away or play it, record it. That way, I have at least an idea of the melody plus the words.
We're talking with Yasmeen. Her last name is Bowers. You may know that name from Wisconsin Music Annals. The new CD is called The Nautilus. She is a daughter of Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin. Let's digress. You grew up in a musical family. T. Bruce Bowers, your dad, Big Top Chautauqua, Blue Canvas Orchestra fame. A lot of good musicians in those groups. He doesn't need an intro. I'm not as familiar with your mom, although I did see her in your interviews, the naughty interviews. I should bring that out because that's kind of clever. Naughty with N-A-U-T-Y, as in short for Nautilus. Your dad's a good fiddle player, extraordinaire, actually. Tell me about your mom.
Yeah, my mom, well, she, for a very long time, was a singer-songwriter as well. That's actually how my parents met. My dad was the producer on her album, and she toured for a lot of years playing guitar and writing songs. But she retired from that about 7 years ago, and she's a writer as well. She wrote for a paper, local paper, for a long time, and now she's freelancing as a journalist, as a writer.
It's all about the chapters we talked about earlier. I did not name them. Before, falling, distance, broken, healing, and after. Those all relate to love. You've said the album is about love. The interviews that you did, was that part of the process?
The interviews came after the album was complete, but I always had the idea of wanting to do something like that, some sort of a video interview. And I think it really comes from that urge to connect with other people's experiences, see what they've learned. You know, everyone has a different life experience, though we have these similar connections. I learned a lot. It was very, very fun.
All right, here comes question number 5.
All right.
Another step back. With all that music around you as you were growing up, was it difficult or was it easy to make your own music? Are you a hybrid of all you heard growing up? Did you need to break out of your shell and be something unique?
Well, I would say that I definitely incorporated all that music that was a part of my childhood and played a lot of music with my parents as well. That was pretty natural, but there was also an urge to step out. And I remember my first instrument when I was 5 years old was actually the violin, the same as my dad. I remember even at that age feeling like, well, I don't want to do the same thing as my dad, so I chose the piano instead. From there, I think probably when I first started listening and studying Cuban music, that was where I kind of found something that was more mine. I mean, not that we didn't share it. We all studied together and practiced, but that was something that it drew me in, and that was like my own little world.
Well, you've already had the hometown release of the album, which was on the 23rd of June. But this Friday in Minneapolis at the Ice House, you have the official release.
Well, it's going to be a great night. So I've got my full band. It's a 6-piece band. We have a DJ who's going to be spinning some salsa in between sets. And then after us, a great band, Almandina. They're a South American dance group from based out of Minneapolis.
Hmm.
And they play all over the docket. It's very eclectic, but mostly South American dance music, cumbia, salsa, merengue, things like that. And then there will be some dance guests and also some other musical guests performing with me.
You have kind of a, from what I saw on your website, a busy July and August. You're going to be you're going to be traipsing all over Wisconsin.
Yes, quite a bit. Yeah.
All right. So now some of what we've just been discussing was not put in the form of a question purposely.
Yeah.
Because here comes question number six.
Okay.
How do we get the album?
Very good questions. How to get the album. Starting on July 6th, official launch date, it will be all over the internet, iTunes, Spotify, you name it. You can get it online starting that day, also through my website. Also, that day, you can get the physical copies through me, and it will also be available on CD Baby physical copy through there. So,
do the musical aggregations that you play with, do they go by just Yasmin, or do they have names? What do they have?
Well, we've been talking about that. Right as of now, yes, Yasmin for all of the promo materials. For example, we played Trempolo, me and my drummer, who's visiting from Havana, Cuba, on vacation for a month, but we're playing a little bit, and we don't have a name as a duo, and I think we need one. We've both been looking at each other like, we can't just be Yasmin. This isn't working.
Well, good luck with that. The CD is called The Nautilus, the artist. Her name is Yasmin. Her last name is Bowers, and that's a big name in Wisconsin. So she can ride in on coattails. Don't blame her for doing that. Thanks so much for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. And I love the music, and I sure hope you keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Al.
Again, you were just listening to Spectrum West host Al Ross interviewing Yasmin Bowers about her latest album, Nautilus. From that album, this is the song, When You Were Mine.
Everywhere, love is in the air, talking cards and chocolate roses to show her that you care. Buy her pretty things, shiny silver rings, plastic hearts and colored candy and lacy underwear, but there's nothing really there. It seems so strange now, I have changed now.
And before we let you go, just a brief recap of the news this week. Governor Scott Walker is asking the Federal Emergency Management Agency to assess flood damage across 7 counties in northern Wisconsin. Counties are reporting that heavy rains last month caused an estimated $11 million in damage to roads. Wisconsin Emergency Management spokeswoman Lori Getter says teams from FEMA will be in northern Wisconsin Monday to begin damage assessments. Getter expects federal workers will be in the area for 4 to 5 days next week.
They'll be looking at mainly public infrastructure such as bridges and roads, and they'll also be looking at debris cost removal.
Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler says they saw more than $5 million in damage to roads.
I'll say somewhere maybe about 25% that are closed, waiting for contractors, waiting for money, hoping that FEMA will come and help pay, because some of the costs of these repairs exceed the entire budget for some of these townships.
Bayfield County Emergency Management Director Jan Victorson says her county sustained more than $2 million in road damage.
I can't say enough about our town folks who have just stepped up to the plate, have gathered information when what they really wanted to be doing was fixing roads in order to try to keep this process moving, to try to get funding back into our communities.
About 80 homes and businesses reported flood damage, but FEMA teams will only assess damage to public infrastructure. Air quality monitoring in Superior neighborhoods that began after a series of fires and explosions at the city's oil refinery in April has come to an end. Husky Energy says monitoring will continue at its facility. The refinery ended community air monitoring in mid-June after finding contaminant levels did not pose a risk to human health. Husky had been monitoring the air for volatile organic chemicals and things like carbon monoxide. Superior Mayor Jim Payne says he's confident the company is doing its job to keep the community safe.
State and federal agencies are on this too, and they are not beholden to Husky in any meaningful way. And they are not all the same agency. So everybody's coming to the same conclusion that there's just no known risk to human health here.
A spokeswoman with the Environmental Protection Agency says they agreed there was no longer a need for community air monitoring. A spokesman with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says the company is reporting no issues with air quality at the facility. And high water levels on Lake Superior is spelling trouble for some shoreline communities. One town is contending with erosion and property damage due to high lake levels and storms. Lauren Fry with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says they're forecasting water levels on Lake Superior will remain above average over the next 6 months.
While erosion always occurs, it's occurring closer to people's infrastructure, so the impacts are related to property damage.
In one town on Lake Superior, that's made damage from storms even worse. Beverly Steele with the town of Clover, or better known as Herbster, says it may cost $125,000 to repair a road damaged by storms late last fall.
When we first had the little erosion that was threatening the road, the old timers said, well, just let nature take its course because it always heals itself. And this time it didn't heal itself.
Steele says if they fix the road this year, they may have to raise property taxes to pay for the project. A town hall meeting will be held about the road this Saturday from 10 to noon in Herbster. And that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. And you can find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.